Welcome to the Entrepreneur Organization Business Podcast. I am your host, Lynn Peretti. Today, you're in for a treat as our guest is none other than Vern Harnish, the founder of EO himself. Vern is a world-leading expert, speaker, author, and entrepreneur in the field of business growth. He is also the founder and CEO of Scaling Up, a global executive education and coaching company with over 180 partners spanning six continents. With over 30 years of experience educating entrepreneurial teams, Vern has made it his personal mission to support entrepreneurs. He co-founded Growth Institute, a premier online training company that has assisted mid-market companies in over 50 countries in learning and implementing the latest business methodologies. Vern is also the author of Scaling Up, Mastering the Rockefeller Habit, and along with the editors of Fortune, he co-authored The Greatest Business Decisions of All Time, for which Jim Collins wrote the foreword. In this episode, Vern shares his personal journey growing up in an entrepreneurial household. He explained how Steve Jobs inspired him to start EO and offers valuable advice for entrepreneurs navigating through crisis and more. This episode is packed with a wealth of knowledge and experiences, and I'm sure you will thoroughly enjoy it. So, without further ado, let's welcome Vern and deep dive into the conversation. Welcome to the show, Vern. I cannot believe you're here.
Well, it's always great to spend time with fellow EOers.
Yeah, I was fortunate to meet you in real life maybe a month or two ago. And yeah, I mean, I've even stumbled across your book years before I came across EO. So today I feel really privileged to be talking to you. And as a new member of EO, I think a lot of us would want to know about, like, how did you start EO? And even, like, how did you become an entrepreneur? So it is going to be a little bit of a long episode, but I would love for you to start off with just sharing a little bit about, you know, your story of growing up and how you became an entrepreneur in the first place.
Got it. Well, my grandparents were both entrepreneurs on my dad's side. And then my dad was actually a rocket engineer on the Titan missile program. And he and his three buddies left and started a rocket ship of a company called Higher Electronics. And so then I got to grow up watching him build that company. He'd take me to business meetings and go to the bars with him. He'd sit me in the corner to watch kind of what was going on. And they built that to a significant firm. And then he lost it all in the 73 recession. And he never really recovered from it. It's one of the things that's very missional for me around EO is hopefully no other entrepreneur goes through what my dad and our family went through. So anyway, we ended up moving from Colorado to Kansas. And to make some money for the family, he and I started an appliance repair business. There was a local Sears catalog store. So I met, in fact, all my girlfriends through the appliance that I repaired at their home. And then when I went to college, I joined my wholesaler company called Superior Supply Company, and I moved up and became number two. We were about 12 million. I was headed up all sales and marketing while I was an undergraduate. But the president was a white PO-er, and it was the founder's son. And I knew I was never going to be president. So here I'd helped kind of scale a $12 million company while in college. And so one of our board members was building the Center for Entrepreneurship at Wichita State. And Fran had also been involved in building about 75 other companies, including Learjet and many others. And so he asked me to join him to build the Center for Entrepreneurship. And that was 1982. And that was really the beginning of saying, all right, I've kind of watched companies build. I've helped build companies. Now it was time for me to help others. And so in 83, he and I co-founded a group called ACE, Association of Collegiate Entrepreneurs. And as a publicity stunt, I had convinced the famous John Naisbitt, who wrote a book called Megatrends, to use this fancy thing we didn't know was called the internet back then, to identify the top 100 young entrepreneurs under the age of 30. And I figured if I could give Steve Jobs and Bill Gates and Michael Dell an award, they might then show up to speak to all these student groups. Well, it worked, and he became global overnight. And the culmination was in 1986, I had a chance to host the first public speech Steve Jobs ever gave after being fired from Apple. And he was really depressed. I mean, here, could you imagine? All of us see our businesses as our babies. And he had it ripped literally from his arms. And so in that spring of 86, I had about 1,200 young entrepreneurs in the audience. I had Michael Dell and Mark Cuban and Neil Balter, California Closets, and others all sitting up there with Steve Jobs. And he gave the final speech. He was number one on the list. And a lot of folks don't realize Bill Gates was just number four on the list at $256 million, which was a lot of revenue for a 29-year-old. Steve Jobs was the same age. And a lot of folks just assumed Apple was a lot smaller than Microsoft. Yeah, Apple was $1.9 billion when Steve was 29. He was eight times the size. I mean, he really was the original young entrepreneur. He showed that somebody in their 20s could scale a company not to $1 billion in valuation, but to almost $2 billion in revenue. And he ended up staying that night for the party that I hosted, but he stood alone by himself in the corner. And I remember at that moment, a mentor of mine, Joe Mancuso's line, "It's okay to be independent, but no reason to be alone." And it was at that moment I knew that there needed to be an organization for the Steve Jobs of the world. And so that was the night the idea was birthed. It took me about a year to raise the money, put the board together, the founding board, and for our first independent event, which was in 1987. So that's why this is our 36th anniversary of the organization. But in short, the mascot, if you would, for YEO, now EO, is Steve Jobs. And he went on to scale the largest market cap company in the world, and it still is. You know,
That's amazing. So you're saying the event with Steve Jobs was just prior to actually the launch of EO. So you just kind of gathered entrepreneurs and did an event before you officially turned it into something.
I did. It was his speech and him staying that night that was the inspiration for launching. Now, I had grown up around YPOers, so I knew the YPO model. And so really the idea of YEO was to be an organization like YPO, but for entrepreneurs only. And that's what we are today. And I'm excited that EO and YPO have signed officially a joint document to do events together. And in fact, I'll be heading to China to do a joint EO-YPO event in Macau. And so looking forward to get back to that country.
Yeah, that's my next question too. So I can just feel like when I joined YPO was like the next level, and I saw it as like a brother to it. So what is kind of the arrangement? Is it just kind of like a joint venture between the two, or is there any, what kind of relationship do we have with YPO?
You know, it's very informal. We structured ourselves exactly like YPO.
Mm-hmm.
And that way it makes it really easy for EO members that want to move into YPO can. At the same time, EO is inventing new organizations like EO Plus that allows the larger entrepreneurs to stay in the organization. But we did, just before the pandemic, sign an official agreement that it was, quote, legal or okay to do events together. And since that was signed at the very top of the organization, since then, it's been fun to host some joint EO YP program.
Oh, that's awesome. Okay. So I just wanted to go back a little bit about it with your childhood. So I can see that you grew up in a family that was already entrepreneurial. Your parents were, you know, ambitious kind of people. What did they instill in you that made you also want to succeed? Because, sometimes as parents, we're worried that we succeed, we hustle, and then the next generation kind of like, takes it easy and don't have that drive because the parents already have the drive. So what was it that the way your parents taught you that made you go, I want to be like you or even, more than you?
Well, so are you a parent? Do you have children?
Yeah, I'm a parent. I'm a parent.
How many? How many children?
I have three of ages between 8 to 20.
Oh my gosh. You look so young. I have four children, ages 16 to 27.
Mm.
And I think the key thing I learned as a parent, you probably have as well, is can we set it up so that at some point your child tastes real success? Mm-hmm. Once they get that personal real success taste in their mouth, I think we're done raising them. I think then they know what they need to do to kind of self-motivate and self-learn. And so, You know, the key thing, Dad exposed me to a couple of key books that a lot of entrepreneurs have read, and that is the Napoleon Hill, Think and Grow Rich. Mm-hmm. Used to listen to the audio tapes in the car when I was traveling with him. But the first book he gave me was called The Magic of Thinking Big. And that always has inspired me to do big things. And I'm super excited that EO today is doing big things and that it's global. And so I think it was a lot around the learning that he shared. And that's what excites all of us about EO, is that first and foremost is a place for us to learn how to, you know, be better leaders, better parents, better significant others.
Yeah, yeah. Awesome. So just talking about the book, when did you decide to write Scaling Up? Because it in itself is an amazing book that even people who didn't join EO, you know, is still embracing it and you know, sharing it around. So how did you come around in writing that book? When was it launched? And yeah, what was the motivation for that?
Yeah. Well, YPO, Lynn, had a program with Harvard. So I thought, well, EO should have one as well. So I actually went over to Harvard. Harvard said, no way are we going to do this. So I went next door to MIT. And back in 1991, kind of my last hurrah, I launched what became known today as EMP, the Entrepreneurial Masters Program, with both Inc. Magazine and MIT. And because the challenge was, there's a lot of information on how to start up a business. I think there's an incubator, I swear, on every corner. I have an MBA that's supposed to teach you how to run a big company. But there really wasn't the parenting manual. You know, as a parent, there's no on how to parent, right? I know there's a lot of them, but they didn't really give us a manual. And there really wasn't a manual on how to scale up or grow up a business from startup to grown up. So I took 10 years between 91 and 2001, and we moved a little over 1,000 entrepreneurs through that MIT program. And I got to host all of these top authors and top business leaders, which is why in my book, I feature over 40 other thought leaders and authors, because I hardly have all the answers. And that culminated then in me publishing in 2002, Mastering the Rockefeller Habits. And that really codified what we had learned over those 10 years that were necessary in order to scale up a business. And then 12 years later, in 2014, I wrote its companion, Scaling Up. We decided to go deeper and wider. And then last year in 2022, my favorite year, I revised both of those books and brought them up to speed. So there's a new 20th anniversary edition of Mastering the Rockefeller Habits, which is, by the way, the one I really think everybody should read first. It's much simpler. And I think it's easier for the employees to understand as well. And then Scaling Up is really the master's course, if you would. So there's the beginner's course and the master's course that people can read.
Yeah, yeah, I totally love it. And every time that I attend one of those learning days, I always feel like it's a completely new day again, because it's just, the concept is simple but hard to do. And you got to really, like, you walk away with so much action steps that, yeah, every time I have a refresher yearly, I still feel like I gain so much. Let's talk about EO.
By the way, let me comment on that. You know, it's one of the things that drives me crazy. You know, I don't, do you play golf or tennis or anything?
Table tennis, I do.
You do? All right. Well, we'll have to play table tennis the next time I see you. By the way, that's one of the three rules with all four of my children, is they've had to master the three P's: ping pong or table tennis, pool, and poker.
Oh, good at that too.
Those are the three most important life skills I've been, or bargaining skills, if you will. But anyway, you know, what it takes to master table tennis or golf, how often do you have to review the fundamentals? Like every swing, right? Every swing. Yet in business, we have this crazy idea that I read that book 10 years ago and somehow or another, I've mastered it. I think it's more important for you to pick a handful of books or a handful of ideas and continually review them than it is the flavor of the month. And so I think, like mastering any sport, if you want to master business, you've got to keep going back to the fundamentals. And so urge folks who are serious about utilizing our platform to read at least Mastering the Rockefeller Habits, review it at least once a year so that you get those fundamentals.
That's a really important reminder because I feel like I'm FOMO and want to read whatever the latest book is and what's next. Yeah. And you're right. It's like only when I take time and summarize and really digest do I get so much juice out of it. And imagine doing that yearly. That would be like amazing. So definitely an action step for me.
Well, and it's, you know, our best performing clients like Scott Nash, Mom's Organic Market. You know, it's not Google or Facebook. He's got organic supermarkets. But he started with this at 10 million. He'll do about 300 million this year. And he comes every 6 months to one of our workshops, he and his team, just to continually review the fundamentals. Scott is there every time. And many of our other clients as well. And so, and you know, the line, you can't cross the same river twice. You know, when you come back 6 months or a year, you're a different leader. You're a different company. And you see these fundamentals through a different lens, and that's important.
100%. Okay, so I want to go back to EO, and I want to treat it like it is a business, right? And so how did you grow it? What was the first year like, 5 years like, and now with like 18,000 members around the world, like what kind of challenge do we have now compared to when you first started?
Yeah, well, it was as messy as most startups. It was literally 80-hour, 100-hour weeks. I never took, by the way, a penny or a salary from EO. And in those first 4 years, the most important decision I made was I hired a number two. He was a student of mine, Mo Fottlebaum. Today, everybody knows Mo is one of the top forum trainers in the world. But he was a student of mine at University of Maryland. I was teaching part-time in the evening as one of the ways to make money, as well as run a couple of companies. And he was one of my best students. So I brought him on. And he then became the executive director in 1990, the end of 1990. And he 10X'd the business, the organization, in terms of membership. So that was a critical decision. Number two, it's not really known well in the history, but YPO was not happy that I named it YEO, right? It was going to create brand confusion in the marketplace. So probably the second most important decision I made is I went up to go see the founder of YPO, Ray Hickok, and I recruited him to be the honorary founder of YEO. So the minute we had the founder of YPO as the honorary founder of YPO, it was game over. YPO then, you know, essentially let us be, which was important. And then I think the third thing was, you know, one of the key ways to build a brand is to bolt on other bigger brands. And so when I launched that executive program in 91, if I just called it the YPO, whatever, I would have been lucky to get three people, you know, to show up. But because I partnered with MIT, a really good university brand, and Inc. Magazine, a good publication, well-known in at least the United States, we had over 800 applicants for that first 48. And many of those 800 applicants went on to be the members that helped us go from 150 to 1,500 members quite quickly. So, it's one of the things entrepreneurs learn, and we all do, is you really only have to make one or two good decisions every 4 or 5 years. Warren Buffett, in fact, even said it this year in his letter to the shareholders. He said, you know, I think I've only made about a dozen good decisions. That's one every 5 years. But that's really all you have to do. And those were the two or three good decisions I made.
Yeah, that's amazing. And so like, for example, the idea of, okay, I'm going to make him an honorable president or I'm going to partner with his companies. Like, where did you get those ideas from? Who were you talking to? How did you kind of, what was the problem you're facing? And then that led you to go, okay, this is a great idea.
Man, this is why you do podcasts. You're a great interviewer. That curiosity is one of the keys, you know, to success. It's a great question. And so, key to me scaling the Association of Collegiate Entrepreneurs globally in 36 months, and then getting done when I did at YEO, was really credited to Regis McKenna. Regis was Steve Jobs' advisor in the marketing area. Great product. He wrote a book called Relationship Marketing. And he's the one that helped Apple, Intel, Genentech, and most of Silicon Valley scale significantly. So in 1983, I just cold called Regis, picked up the phone. We didn't have email or any of that fancy stuff back then. And I had a good pitch. I said, I want to build the world's largest entrepreneur organization. And he took me on as a free client. He said, all right, I'm going to teach you what I taught Steve Jobs. And he said two things. One, you need to have a marketing meeting separate from sales. And so my marketing meeting is 10 a.m. Eastern time every Monday now for 40 years. And he said, number two, you need to, and he asked me the question that Bill Gates considered the best question he'd ever been asked, which is, what are the top 25 influencers that you need to bolt on to your vision, your idea, to really help it scale? And he said, the bigger the names, the faster you will scale. And so, look, I was young, dumb, and broke, a student of Wichita State University. And so I wrote down 1983, President Ronald Reagan, President of the United States. I said, look, I'm going to get him to be the first president to ever use the word entrepreneur. No other U.S. president had ever even uttered that word. Excuse me. And I did. Got invited to the White House. There's a whole other set of stories there. Then I wrote down Steve Jobs. I wrote down Michael Dell. I wrote down Inc. Magazine. I wrote down Venture Magazine. And I wrote down 20 more names. And Lynn, every one of them showed up at that event 3 years later, 1986, including President Reagan had agreed to fly out and give the welcome address, but he got intercepted. So he asked Mayor Bradley of Bradley Airport to do it. And he read a telegram that President Ronald Reagan sent to say how critical young entrepreneurs are to our global economy, our local and global economy. So that was always my MO, is if I want to scale, to bolt on influencers like MIT Inc. So I'll tell you one quick story. So Karen Behnke, who went on to found the San Francisco EO chapter, YEO chapter, she was in that very first MIT class. Well, later she founded a company that wanted to focus on what's called farm to face. She wants to do cosmetics that are raw enough that you could eat them, right, from farm to face. The key, though, to her scaling is she managed to get as her partner, Gwyneth Paltrow, the famous.
Yeah.
You know, all you have to do is bolt on an additional brand like Gwyneth's. And you go from startup to a quarter billion in revenue a year. And so it was really Regis McKenna that taught Steve Jobs and Intel and Bill Gates and me that if you want to scale, to bolt on those kind of influencers. And MIT and Inc. Magazine proved to be important influencers for us.
Okay. Well, my next question is, how do you even bolt onto them thinking that, okay, well, how are they going to talk to me? Do I have the money? Like, what were the method for you to actually connect with big names like that?
Yeah. Well, you know, Steve Jobs said it, and I come back to Steve. You know, when he was 12 years old, he looked in the phone book and found Bill Hewitt's phone number of Hewlett Packard. And he just called Bill, said, hey, I'm Steve Jobs. I'm building this thing and I could use some free parts. And Bill Hewitt was so impressed that Steve, you know, a 12-year-old, picked up the phone and asked that he ended up hiring him as an intern the next year when he was 13 years old. And it was that early mentorship and Steve getting to see what a big company really looks like that I know allowed him to then scale to 2 billion Apple. And so Steve, and you can find it on YouTube, Steve says probably the most important thing you've got to learn is to ask for help. And so, but you need to have a good elevator pitch. And so I'll tell you one other story. So Dave Rogan Mosher, he was an EO member out of Boston. Dave had built two other companies, but not to the scale he wanted to. So he decided to launch a third company, he and his two founders, both founders. And they used our tools that first weekend from day one. A lot of people think our tools are for you know, larger companies, but you know, they startups use them from day one. And the first thing Dave did is he made a list of the 50 key influencers in the space that he wanted to dominate. By the way, he didn't know one of them. So, and by the way, I didn't know President Reagan. I didn't know Steve Jobs. I didn't know Michael Dell. I didn't know Bernie Goldhurst, Unique Magazine, or Arthur Lippert Venture. What you do then is you find one person who does. And so Dave Rogenmoser found one person. He gave him 1% equity in the company. And that gentleman introduced him to 30 on the list. Those 30 got him to the next 18. And within 2 months, 48 of those 50 were talking up his company pre-product. Now let's speed forward. Last fall, he raised $125 million on a $1.5 billion valuation. That company today is called Jasper, which is one of the most successful AI-driven companies we've got right now in the space. But Dave did that by starting with making a list. And you don't say, hey, there's no way I think I can get to this person. No, you make the list. And then you find the people that can help you get to those people.
Yeah. Reminds me of the book I'm currently reading from Dan Sullivan called Who Not How. And it's really about who can help you. And because sometimes you get stuck in the how and then you kind of feel limited, but it's the who. But it's just, you really inspired me to kind of just pick up the phone and go for it. Because I think sometimes you think you need to be very strategic and wait for the right moment, but it's just that bravery.
It is. It is. And again, you've got to have a good elevator pitch, you know, a good job to be done. And there has to be some reason you believe. Like I believe President Reagan would actually care because his theme when he won election was that the economy's stupid. And in 1982, Dave Birch at MIT had just come out with some research that showed that it was gazelles, scale-ups, really are the ones that drive economies. It's the entrepreneurs. And so getting the president's team to see that entrepreneurs are critical to his message was important. So there has to be a connection.
Yeah.
You can't just call up anybody. And clearly, Gwyneth Paltrow cares about the environment. She cares about health. She cares, you know, she cares about beauty. And so all of those come together that it makes sense that she would be the right person Karen would call, not Michael Dell or Elon Musk or even Steve Jobs. So there's got to be some rationale to it.
Yeah. Just curious to know, you know, when I first started entrepreneurship and trying to start a business, I really just thought business is a way to make money, you know, like I just want to make money and then have freedom. And over time it changed, you know, I became more spiritual. I realized relationship mattered more. Business is just one side to, you know, a seven kind of areas in life. And I was just curious to know from your point of view, after you've been running businesses for so long, you've witnessed so many entrepreneurs, like, what can you tell us now about business or entrepreneurship?
Well, I think in here, most of what I teach, I've learned from others, you know, and so it was Jim McKelvey. Jim co-founded Square, and he wrote a great book, Innovation Stack. And in there, he said, there's really a difference between a small business person and an entrepreneur. And I do think even in EO, we need to be more discerning, whether somebody's just a small business person or if they're really an entrepreneur. And what we find with entrepreneurs, and he really used the term, is that at some level, first, they're just crazy. You know, if you've read Elon Musk's biography, and I think everyone listening to this podcast, every entrepreneur on the planet, I don't care what you think about Elon Musk, you've got to read his latest biography by Walter Isaacson, and you're going to really get a great glimpse, as Walter wrote about Steve Jobs as well, into the minds of a real entrepreneur. And what it really comes down to is you're frustrated by something that you want to change and you want to fix for the world or just yourself. Often you start out by, look, I think I'd like to get to Mars, and I think we as people need to get to Mars. And so everything Elon Musk is doing is figuring out how to get us onto another spaceship. This is his version of save the planet. And so that's truly what purpose comes down to, is what is going to be your contribution to saving humanity and making things easier and better? And as you know, it's only entrepreneurs that fix stuff. It's not governments. Yeah. It's not large corporations. It's entrepreneurs. And I'd love for us to get closer to Elon Musk as an organization.
Yeah. I guess what I think what I wanted to say was, what does success mean now to you? I think when I was describing my question, I meant entrepreneurship, but I meant, ultimately, at the beginning, you're fighting for money and flexibility for your family. And, and sometimes you strive and you build more companies. And sometimes I feel like people struggle to find happiness through the vehicle of business that they were after. And so, we'd love to hear your point of view. What does success mean? What does happiness mean as someone who's like an entrepreneur like ourselves?
Yeah. Well, so in the revision of Scaling Up, I radically changed the opening three pages and emphasized the importance of being for purpose as much as for profit. And there's lots of talk about the purpose side, but that really does come back to Steve Jobs, who said, look, he wanted to build computers because he saw them as bicycles for the mind. That was really the purpose statement. He never did it for the money. And so what success means, I think, to me at least, and to many entrepreneurs, is we really have put a dent in the universe, that we've made a difference to people. And I do feel like EO has made a difference to tens of thousands of entrepreneurs. And particularly in the pandemic, if I go back to the reason, the purpose for founding YEO, which is it's okay to be independent, but no reason to be alone, which is when I saw Steve Jobs standing over there by himself, I said, there needs to be an organization for him. I think what's cool is in the pandemic, there were 19,000 entrepreneurs who were not alone. And that's, really feels good. Success. Now, if you were to say happiness, there I'm going to steal from one of our founding board members. One of my founding board was Ted Leonsis. Ted actually designed the first logo for YEO and everything else. He was a great supporter. He wrote a book called The Business of Happiness. And it's a great book. It's one that I encourage every entrepreneur to read, especially since he's one of our founding board members. And in there, he said something very interesting. He said the people he noticed that were happiest were involved in the most different communities. I'll say it again. They were involved in the most different communities. And I realized I was only involved in one community, the entrepreneur community. And so I decided to really branch out. So I'm involved in a for-purpose or nonprofit called Reardon Clinic that I'm vice chair. And we're really involved in alternative approaches to curing diseases. And, it lets me hang out in the medical community. I just visited a winery, a deal that I put together in Spain. And the people that hang out in that business, that industry, are unique. I co-founded out of Panama called GeoVersity. It's involved in, lots of water environmental issues. That's a whole different community of thinkers involved. And I'm working on ending the death penalty in the United States, which really gets you involved in the kind of political community. So the side interests that I have exposing me to these different communities has really been a great source of joy and happiness for me. So,
yeah, and it sounds like it's all kind
of some of your other. What are some of your other communities that you?
Yeah, I mean, as you're saying it, I just realized that I am the happiest I've ever been because I'm very active in my church community. I'm active even giving back to friends where I host fitness workouts every 3 days a week for friends, and I think it comes down to, I think it's more than just community. It's about giving back. It's like you can join a community and just be a receiver and sit there and go, all right, serve me, versus being active, then that actually makes you happy. What would you say about the contribution side to whatever that you're actually doing?
I think you nailed it right there. It is, so I'll tell you a quick story that, and maybe there's some lessons in here. So I was on the board of an organization called NIFTY, National Foundation for Teaching Entrepreneurship. We worked with inner city youth to teach them how to start businesses. And one of the guys on my board was a very famous person in the U.S. named John Whitehead. John was the co-founder of co-chair of Goldman Sachs. He then became under secretary of state under President Reagan. He went on then to redevelop downtown Manhattan after 9/11. So very, very well-respected gentleman. And one day I walked up to him and I said, John, what's something you've learned that you could pass on to me? And he thought for a moment. And he said, the importance to always do a little bit of retail business every day. And he said, let me explain. He said when he was co-chair at Goldman Sachs, even though he's working on multi-billion dollar big global deals, he made a point every day to go down to the trading floor, thousands of traders, and he would have his staff let him know if there was somebody there that had a birthday, could use a pat on the back, would love to meet the chair, co-chair of Goldman Sachs, and maybe just needed a little encouragement. When he became undersecretary of state, again, he's working on big global deals, but he instructed his team every day, to bring in one citizen, American citizen, that was stranded someplace or needed some help or was being accused of something that they weren't, guilty of, and just needed somebody way up in government to lend him a hand. And so I thought, you know what? Every day, because I wrote these books and founder VO and all that, I get people that reach out to me saying, hey, I'd like to do a podcast. I could use some help. Could you advise me? And I said, you know what? I'm going to do a little bit of retail business every day. And I set aside minutes or so to help somebody out who's just reached out.
Yeah.
And that has been a source of, I think, giving back. You don't have to think about it in big terms.
Yeah.
It's going to be somebody that shows up every day. One of your employees, one of your customers, a neighbor, somebody that, if you keep your antenna up, gives you a reason to do a little bit of retail business every
day. Yeah.
I think that's as important as some of the big stuff that we might want to accomplish.
100%. Like, I just love that because I even try to, I journal every day and I keep a track of kindness. So I try to do something kind, even if it's writing a LinkedIn recommendation for no reason or, proactively offer to drive someone. I think it's those little things that give you the most joy than trying to save up and try to plan a big surprise for someone, right? Because that's just like someday, somewhere along the line. But it's the everyday that we have so much control over our happiness. So I'm so glad that we have a lot in common there. Just jump back into the EO when you were talking about the pandemic. That was one of the craziest time and it really tested us as entrepreneurs as well as EO. Were there any other time in the history of EO that was like very tested like that? Or was the pandemic the most serious time for EO?
No, I think at the turn of the century when the whole tech industry collapsed, in that very first MIT class was Brad Fell, who went on to co-found Techstars and was SoftBank's representative in the United States. I mean, he tells some hairy stories. And by the way, I almost lost my company right then in 2001 when 9/11 occurred. I lost $1 million over about 6 weeks. And I was scaling rapidly. And so that almost killed my company. The Great Recession was a tough time for a lot of folks in 2008 around the globe. And a lot of the entrepreneurs in the pigs countries, Portugal, Italy, Ireland, what was it, Greece and Spain, they really had some tough, particularly tough times during that Great Recession. So I think we've had many times. Right now, we've got a war going on, and we've got a coaching partner in Israel who we've been supporting through all of this. And it's affected a lot of EO members in that region. I mean, I can't imagine a pandemic's bad, but a war, and our members in Ukraine and the like. So, hey, there's always tough times.
What's happened?
And it was interesting. At the beginning of the pandemic, I hosted a good friend of mine, Greg Brenneman. Greg turned around Continental Airlines and kind of a dozen other companies. And he said something really profound. He said, our job as a leader is to absorb fear and exude hope. And again, our job is to absorb fear and to exude hope. It's not fair, but leadership is a privilege, not a right. And so if you've signed up to be an entrepreneur and you're leading people, then you need to suck it up and take responsibility for that. And so I thought that was a really powerful line for all of us.
It's a really great quote. And it's interesting. It actually was a bit comforting to know that it's happened a lot of times. It's happened before, only because you realize that life is always going to throw us storm. And, you know, it's about surviving and knowing that it will end eventually something, you know, even though at that time it feels like it will never end, but it eventually ends. So what advice would you give to someone that's going through it right now? You know, maybe they're caught in the war, or maybe even a smaller scale that their business is struggling at the moment. Like, you know, what can you share with them from what you've learned about storms and challenges?
Yeah. Well, if they want to Google the 5 C's of dealing with a crisis. It's a piece I wrote literally the weekend of the beginning of the pandemic. And I published it. The pandemic really started on that Friday, the 13th, March 13th, for most of the world, at least our world, shut down. And on Monday, I published this piece, the 5 C's of dealing in a crisis. And I've shared that, by the way, with the entrepreneurs in these various regions. So first, I'd have people take a look at that. But a big part of it is just to remain calm and to over-communicate. Those are two of the C's. Mm. And a lot of us made sure that we were messaging. We're big into the daily huddle, but we went further in daily messaging how we felt the company was doing. And the idea in a crisis is to piece together little wins. Mm. Let's just have a win over the next hour and be fine with that. And figure out, what do we have to do the next hour? And be happy with those kind of small steps. So that's part of the key. Then the other person we hired at the beginning of the pandemic was Margaret Heffernan. And was one of the top 100 women CEOs. She wrote the book on women entrepreneurs. And Margaret said, there's only one strategy, and that is to be ambitious. And so I just went to my 88th country, Brazil, and I saw the EO Brazil members down there. And Brazil has this very famous Formula One race car driver who died way too young. But he has this famous quote. It's impossible to pass cars when it's sunny, but you can pass 15 when it's raining. And so my view is, whenever it's raining, you know, interest rates, inflation, war, whatever, if you're willing to be ambitious, this is the time to pass the competition. And so I think what I love about entrepreneurs is they see opportunity in every situation. And that's the only way I think you can get through it.
Mm, that is so inspiring. I love that metaphor as well. Well, as I know it's getting late for you, and I promise you will only go for 45, I want to wrap it up by saying, like, look, I think that you've done a phenomenal job with EO. Like, I love EO. I just joined only about a year or so ago, and I love it. And so you've already left a big piece of impact and legacy. But what do you ultimately want to be remembered for? Like, if you were to, you know, pass away, we all pass away eventually, what do you want the world to say about Vern Harnish?
Yeah, no entrepreneur was left behind.
Mm. Yeah.
It's why when I'm speaking with the leadership team, when I'm over in Asia, I think we should be 10X or 100X the size. I mean, I'm proud that we're at almost 19,000. I think we should be at 190,000 or 1.9 million. We should be equivalent to the almost revenue of Steve Jobs. So I'd love to see us 10X or 100X our reach and our impact, so that we don't leave any entrepreneur behind.
Yeah. Deep down, do you just want to beat YPO?
No, not at all. It's a totally different organization. Yeah. For sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
No. And YPO should be, with all the presidents there are in the world.
Yeah.
I think both organizations could be bigger.
Yeah, that's so funny. It's so cute, because I just love the fact that, you know, YPO was a big brother, really helped, you know, the little brother really thrive. And yeah, Yeah. So I think, yeah, as a family, we work together to really just, you know, give back to the world, whether you're CEO or founders. But thank you so much. I really enjoyed this conversation. I can't wait for the rest of the EO chapters to listen to it. So thank you again, Vern.
You're welcome. Take care, Lynn. Bye-bye. Yeah.